said. Who owes me big? Big enough to deliver? Always. Dixon came off the 101 at sunset and headed west to the hotel. The traffic was slow. Less than 3 miles, but a jogger could have covered them faster. When they eventually arrived, they found a Crown Vic waiting out front. An unmarked cop car. Not Thomas Brandt's. This one was newer and intact, and a different color. It was Curtis Mawney's car. He climbed out as soon as Dixon got parked. He walked over, short, solid, worn, tired. He stopped directly in front of Reacher and paused a beat. Then he asked, "Did one of your friends have a tattoo on his back?" A gentle tone of voice, quiet, sympathetic. Reacher said, "Ah, Christ." Chapter 36. Manuel Orozco had gone through 4 years of college on army money and had assumed he would wind up a combat infantry officer. His baby sister had gone through a major, irrational panic and had assumed he would wind up KIA with serious, disfiguring facial wounds such that his body would not be identified on recovery. She would never know what had happened to him. He told her about dog tags. She said they might get blown off or lost. He told her about fingerprints. She said he might lose limbs. He told her about dental identification. She said his whole jaw might get exploded. Later, he realized she was worrying on a deeper level. But at the time, he thought the answer to her fears was to get a big tattoo across his upper back that said, Orozco, M, in large black letters, with his service number equally large below. He had gotten home and peeled off his shirt in triumph and had been mystified when the kid had cried even harder. Ultimately, he had avoided the infantry and ended up a key part of the 110th MP, where Reacher had immediately rechristened him Kitbag, because his broad, olive back looked like a GI duffel with its name and number stencil. Now, 15 years later, Reacher stood in the Chateau Marmont's sun-blasted parking lot and said, "You found another body." "I'm afraid we did." "Where?" "Same general area, in a gully." "Helicopter?" "Probably." "Orozco," Reacher said. "That's the name on his back," Mawney said. "So why ask?" "We have to be sure. All corpses should be so convenient." "Who's the next of kin?"
"He has a sister somewhere. Younger. So you should make the formal ID. If you would. This really isn't the kind of thing a younger sister should see." "How long was he in the gully?"
"A long time."
They got back in the car, and Dixon followed Mawney all the way to a county facility north of Glendale. Nobody spoke. Reacher sat in the back next to O'Donnell and did what he was pretty sure O'Donnell was doing too, which was to run through a long, involuntary sequence of remembered Orozco moments. The guy had been a comedian, part on purpose, part unwittingly. He had been of Mexican descent, born in Texas and raised in New Mexico, but for many years had pretended to be a white Australian. He had called everyone Mike. As an officer, his command skills had been first rate, but he had never really issued orders. He would wait until a junior officer or a grunt had grasped the general consensus, and then he would say, "If you wouldn't mind, Mike, please." It had become a group catchphrase every bit as ubiquitous as, "You do not mess." "Coffee? If you wouldn't mind, mate, please." "Cigarette? If you wouldn't mind, mate, please." "Want me to shoot this mother? If you wouldn't mind, mate, please." O'Donnell said, "We knew already. This is not a surprise." Nobody answered him. The county facility turned out to be a brand new medical center with a hospital on one side of a wide new street. On the other side was a state-of-the-art receiving station for townships without morgues of their own. It was a white, concrete cube set on stilts a story high. Meat wagons could roll right under the bulk of the building to hidden elevator doors. Neat, clean, discreet, Californian. Mawny parked in a line of visitor slots near some trees. Dixon parked right next to him. Everyone got out and stood for a moment, stretching, looking around, wasting time. Nobody's favorite trip. Mawny led the way. There was a personnel elevator opening off a cross-hatched walkway. Mawny hit the call button, and the elevator doors slid back and cold chemical air spilled out. Mawny stepped on, then Reacher, then O'Donnell, then Dixon, then Nagley. Mawny pressed 4. The fourth floor was as cold as a meat locker. There was a miserable public viewing area with a wide internal window backed by a Venetian blind. Mawny passed it by and headed through a door to a storage area. 3 walls showed the fronts of refrigerated drawers, dozens of them. The air was bitter with cold and heavy with smells and noisy from reflections off stainless steel. Mawny pulled a drawer. It came out easily on ball-bearing runners, full length. It smacked all the way open against end stops made of rubber. Inside was a refrigerated corpse. Male, Hispanic. The wrists and the ankles were tied with rough twine that had bitten deep. The arms were behind the back. The head and the shoulders were grievously damaged, almost unrecognizable as human.
"He fell head first," Reacher said softly. "He would, I guess, tied up like that, if you're right about the helicopter."
"No tracks to or from," Mawny said. Further medical details were hard to discern. Decomposition was well advanced, but due to the desert heat and dryness, it looked more like mummification. The body was shrunken, diminished, collapsed, leathery. It looked empty. There was some animal damage, but not much. Contact with the gully's walls had prevented more. Mawny asked, "Do you recognize him?"
"Not really," Reacher said.
"Check the tattoo." Reacher just stood there, Mawny said.
"Want me to call an orderly?"
Reacher shook his head and put a hand under the corpse's icy shoulder. Lifted. The body rolled awkwardly, all of a piece, stiff like a log or a stump. It settled face down, the arms flung upward, tied and contorted as if the desperate struggle for freedom had continued until the very last. Which it undoubtedly had, Reacher thought. The tattoo was a little folded and creased and wrinkled by the sloughing looseness of the skin and the unnatural inward pressure of the upper arms. It was a little faded by time, but it was unmistakable. It said, "Orozco, M." Under it was a 9-digit service number.
"It's him," Reacher said. "It's Manuel Orozco."
Mawny said, "I'm very sorry." There was silence for a moment. Nothing to hear except pooled air forcing its way through aluminum vents. Reacher asked,
"Are you still searching the area?"
"For the others?" Mawny said. "Not actively. It's not like we've got a missing child."
"Is Franz in here, too? In one of these damn drawers?"
"You want to see him?"
Mawny asked.
"No," Reacher said.
Then he looked back at Orozco and asked,
"When is the autopsy?"
"Soon."
"Is the string going to tell us anything?"
"It's probably too common."
"Do we have an estimate on when he died?"
Mawny half-smiled, cop to cop. "When he hit the ground?"
"Which was when?"
3-4 weeks ago. Before Franz, we think. But we may never know for sure."
"We will," Reacher said.
"How?" Mawny asked.
"I'll ask whoever did it.
And he'll tell me. By that point, he'll be begging to." "No independent action,"
remember? In your dreams.
Morney stayed to process paperwork, and Reacher and Nagley and Dixon and O'Donnell took the elevator back down to warmth and sunlight. They stood in the lot, saying nothing, doing nothing, just crackling and trembling and twitching with suppressed rage. It was a given that soldiers contemplate death. They live with it. They accept it. They expect it. Some of them even want it. But deep down, they want it to be fair. Me against him, may the best man win. They want it to be noble. Win or lose, they want it to arrive with significance. A soldier dead with his arms tied behind him was the worst kind of outrage. It was about helplessness and submission and abuse. It was about powerlessness. It took away all the illusions.
Let's go, Dixon said. We're wasting time.
Chapter 37. At the hotel, Reacher sat for a moment with the photograph Mawney had given him, the video surveillance frame, the pharmacy, four men in front of the counter. Manuel Orozco on the left, glancing right, restless. Then Calvin Franz, hands in his pockets, patience on his face. Then Tony Swan looking straight ahead. Then Jorge Sanchez on the right, his finger hooked under his collar. Four friends. Two down, for sure. Presumably, all four down.
Shit happens, O'Donnell said.
Reacher nodded. And we get over it.
Do we?
Nagley said.
Will we this time?
We always have before.
This never happened before.
My brother died.
I know. But this is worse.
Reacher nodded again. Yes, it is.
I was hoping the other three were still okay somehow.
We all were.
But they're not. They're all gone.
Looks that way.
We need to work, Dixon said.
That's all we got now. They went up to Dixon's room, but work was a relative term. They were dead-ended. They had nothing to go on. Those feelings didn't improve any when they transferred to Nagley's room and found an email response from her Pentagon contact. Sorry, no way, New Age is classified. Just seven words, blank and dismissive.
Seems he doesn't owe you all that big, O'Donnell said.
He does, Nagley said. Bigger than you could imagine. This says more about New Age than him and me.
She scrolled on through her inbox, then she stopped. There was another message from the same guy. Different version of his name, different email address.
Disposable, Nagley said. That's a one-time free account.
She clicked on the message. It said, Francis, great to hear from you. We should get together. Dinner and a movie? And I need to return your Hendrix CDs. Thanks so much for the loan. I love them all. The sixth track on the second album is dynamically brilliant. Let me know when you're next in Washington. Please call soonest.
Reacher said,
You own CDs?
No, Nagley said. I especially don't own Jimi Hendrix CDs. I don't like him.
O'Donnell said,
You've been to movies and dinner with this guy?
Never.
So he's confusing you with some other woman?
Unlikely, Reacher said.
It's coded, Nagley said. That's what it is. It's the answer to my question, got to be. A kosher reply from his official address and then a coded follow-up from an unofficial address. His ass is covered both ways.
Dixon asked, What's the code?
Something to do with the sixth track on the second Hendrix album.
Reacher said, What was the second Hendrix album? O'Donnell said,
Electric Ladyland? That was later, Dixon said. The first was Are You Experienced? Which one had the naked women on the cover? That was Electric Ladyland. I love that cover. You're disgusting. You were 8 years old, nearly nine.